Can anybody tell me from their notes what I was on at the very end of the last? Yes.
Interaction effect, partial over partial X, partial Y.
Okay, fine. Okay, thank you. So I was talking about if you have a pair of theories and you're trying to compare them, see how similar they are, that you can start out by asking, well, what kind of entities do they postulate? Then you can ask which connect with which. And in the nomological net metaphor, nomological meaning laws, one has these entities that connect with each other. And they don't all connect with all the others, but sometimes an entity is connected with another entity by a third one or by two others. And a proper subset of the theoretical entities are connected to observational predicates or functors. A proper subset, not all of them. That's what's wrong with operationism of the traditional sort. Operationism says that all admissible concepts in scientific theories have to be operationally defined in terms of observable predicates and functors, whereas the history of the other sciences shows that that's incorrect, and there's no reason to insist upon it in psychology unless you can show that we're uniquely different from chemistry, genetics, physics, astronomy, blah, blah, like that. What makes the theory is what makes the net an empirical network is that it is tacked down at certain places to observational facts. But many of the entities are not directly tied, and our inference as to their existence and as to their properties and their connections with the others are based upon our ability to derive theorems from the postulates that contain only these terms that are directly coordinated with observation words. Well, I had got down to connect with which. The signs of first and second derivatives, things like flex points and extrema, partial derivatives, ordering of partial derivatives, where we say that one factor is more powerful in its influence than the other. And then you get to the next level, which is actually stating the function forms. That is where you say that y is a logarithmic function of x, or that y, the relationship between x and y, is a hyperbola, or a growth function, or a Gomperz function, or a linear function, or a parabola, or whatever. It's obviously possible to derive, for example, a certain function form without knowing what the constants in that are, as I pointed out in connection with the van der Waals correction for the gas law. If a psychologist thought that some inner state, let's say arousal, a theoretical variable, was a linear function of, say, stimulus intensity. I'll give you a real crude theory, only one intervening variable here. And then if the psychologist thought that some output variable, say, response time, is inversely proportional to the value of that theoretical variable, two plausible conjectures. The brighter the light, the more arousal. He might conjecture he really means something cooking in the reticular activating system, or he might not. And then he says the delay in responding is inversely proportional to that. He doesn't tell you what the constants A and B are, but he knows now that he has X, Y equals K, and that if he plots reaction time against stimulus intensity, he will have a graph which is a hyperbola. And if the graph is not a hyperbola, then he knows that this model is incorrect. Well, and finally, something that's rare with us, but happens all the time to physicists, chemists, and geneticists, is given the function form, one knows the values of the parameters. If you can actually derive the parameters in an equation, of course, that's the ideal case, and that's very impressive. There's a weaker thing to say about the parameters, however, and that is I can't say what A and B and C are in the observational graphs, but I know that they're transferable from one experimental context to another, or I know that in general A tends to be about twice as big as B. And if my theory permits that, that's a risky prediction, which is more than saying it's a log or a parabola, but I say not only is this a log and that's a parabola, but the first term in the parabola, the coefficient on the x squared term, is going to be twice as large as the coefficient on the x term, and that's a risky point prediction. Okay, now in turn, these are those characteristics of resemblance between two theories are, as John Rawls would say, lexically ordered. If you haven't read John Rawls' Theory of Justice, you're missing something. It's a great book. Lexically ordered, meaning that you don't even raise the third one unless you've already settled number one and two. It wouldn't make very much sense, for instance, if I said the first theory has a logarithm and the second theory has a growth function, and now I'm going to compare their parameters, right? I mean, you'd say, well, what do the mathematicians say about that, comparing the constant B, which is up here, versus one which is in front of the logarithm operation. So we don't ask the questions lower down on this list until we've already answered the questions higher up in a way that makes the theories comparable. Now, the extreme limiting case of similarity of two theories is that if they all have the same number of nodes in the net, the nodes are the theoretical entities, and they have the same number of strands, the strands are the theoretical relations between the entities, and the strands are connected to the nodes in the same way, and the mathematical functions that describe the connections are the same ones, so that this is a logarithmic thing and this is a first-degree relationship and so forth, and finally the parameters are the same, then that means that T1 and T2 are empirically identical theories. They have the same formal structure. They're tacked down to the data in the same way, and consequently, it doesn't matter what the theorist's words were. There's an isomorphism between them. Isomorphism formally, mathematically, and an isomorphism empirically in the sense that they subset that are in certain positions in the net are tied to the same kind of facts at the observational level. And so we would say, I don't care. This theorist is talking in terms of libido, and this one is talking in terms of Big D and Hull. And maybe they wouldn't like to talk to each other. We don't care if they talk to each other. We know that they have the same theory, whatever kind of language that they're using. All right, that tells us roughly how we order the similarity between two theories, T1 and T2. Some complicated index of similarity might be concocted from this. I haven't concocted one, but you can see how you might work at it. And my view is that that would be the kind of index that would be more meaningful in the way that the logicians have gone about it. If T1 and T2 can somehow be compared as to their similarity, then we can compare omniscient Jones's theory with our theory, T sub I, and the verisimilitude of Ti is then its similarity to omniscient Jones's theory. All right? Correspondence theory of truth. Verisimilitude of Ti, the similarity of Ti and Tj is an index based upon these kinds of resemblances. And the verisimilitude of Ti is its similarity to Toj, where Toj is the theory held by omniscient Jones. He's a mythical figure, but it's very handy. in exposition to talk about it. Well, with that, I want to go directly to the strategy of Lakatosian defense. But there's a new reference for you, a fascinating book. David Hull is the, together with a fellow named Michael Ruse in Britain, is probably the world's, those two are the world's most eminent philosophers of biology. And he has written this book, which is a nice critique of the going epistemology, also a critique of Popper and Lakatos, to whom I think he is not quite fair. I'm corresponding with him on that score. Really, I think quite unfair to Lakatos in one place. But the other part of the book, aside from the fact that it's interesting, so psychology and sociology of science, deals with things like what kind of followers does it take to sell your doctrines, and why didn't Tolman sell as well as Skinner and Hull? I think he's wrong about he's right about Tolman, but I think he's wrong about Skinner. Even though I'm not a disciple of Skinner, I think that Skinner's theory, which took 15 or 20 years to sell, sold not because of a clique primarily, but because of its objective merits. I mean, anybody who didn't have wax in his ears and blinders in his eyes had to admit that Ione and Azrin shaped up those schizzes, by God, and that people in the Navy could learn code faster with the teaching machine according to Skinner's principles, and so forth. So I think Skinner's doctrine, for what it is, for its domain, sold on the merits. His disciples were quite a few in number, compared with the Hullians, who had metastasized throughout academia. And the reason that Hull wasted away and Skinner is still around is that Skinner's theory is closer to the truth than Hull's theory was. But that's not his view of the matter. The other thing is, being a biologist, he took his leading example of the psychodynamics and the dirty infighting and the referee bias and all of that stuff from the field of biology, namely the controversy in classification theory between the phoneticists, the cladists, or is it cladists? Does anybody know how to pronounce that one? The phoneticists, the cladists, and what we could call the old-fashioned systematists like Ernst Mayr. And the phoneticists think you should group honeybees together in groups on the basis of cluster algorithms, although you don't give a damn where they are in the evolutionary tree. The cladists think that you should use cluster algorithms, but they should be the ones that give you the right evolutionary answer. And the Mayr types want the right evolutionary answer, but don't want to do it statistically at all. There's a little bit like this clinical statistical prediction controversy in psychology. Well, he knows these people quite well personally. People like Sokal, that's from Sneath and Sokal, whose book Numerical Taxonomy is the definitive text among the phoneticists. And I enjoyed reading some of the gossip about old Sokal, because he once wrote a cancerous review as a referee for a paper that Golden and I published, although the editor took it anyway. But Sokal I know not well. He's a nice guy, but he can be pretty owly when it comes to doctrine. So if you need any cure about scientists being human and not the totally objective computer machines, that's a good way to get over that delusion in a hurry. I mean, it's sometimes surprising it goes as well as it does. I mean, how identified people get with their teachers, or how mad they get at the enemy, and how much they think. It turns out that in science, there is a tendency to make a particular doctrine, and even more, a particular method, serve the role that ordinary people with IQs of 100 have served by religion and politics. I'm convinced of that. I mean, I think man is, for some strange reason, either because of evolution or the big committee in the sky, inherently religious. And if you take away the religious kind of religion from him, he'll turn to a Marxist or a Freudian or a phoneticist or a Darwinian or something else. But the rules of the scientific game are tougher, so that the baloney titer gets cut down by main force. So that the fact that scientists sometimes have unsanitary motives of competitiveness or ideology or just plain rigidity, I'm used to thinking about it in this way, don't make me think about it some different way. Despite that, the rules of the game are such that the whole enterprise advances in a way that some other disciplines that should be nameless do not tend to advance. That's a fun book, really fun book. Well, okay, let me go now directly to Lakatosian defense. I told you about Imre Lakatos, I think, the ex-Stalinist who went to the London School of Economics and got a PhD with Karl Popper, and then began to criticize Popper, which Popper didn't appreciate, and I think was doing some extremely important and profound things in amending Popper, a spirit essentially Popperian, but amending Popper in the ways that, in my view, it needs amending. Now, to talk about the Lakatosian defense, we have to sort of diagram the testing of a scientific theory. And keep in mind, again, that I'm talking throughout about theories. I'm not talking about technology. I'm not talking about whether the multiphasic can predict suicide or whether a certain drug cures depression or whatever. I'm talking about testing causal, substantive, explanatory theories. The meal formulation of the Lakatosian defense has more stuff in it than Lakatos. You really need to make some distinctions that he didn't make, although I dare say I could have persuaded him of it if I'd seen him again. And my formulation, which is, I think, in the Two Knights paper, but maybe doesn't have all the variables in it, is... what we are dealing with when we start to test some scientific theory, even a mini theory, like a particular theory about rote learning, what we have is the theory itself that we have our eye on. That's the one we're interested in. That's what is motivating the experiment. Then we have to conjoin to it one or more auxiliary theories, almost always more than one. Even in the exact sciences, it's more than one typically, but in psychology, it's always more than one. And then we have to conjoin to that the ceteris paribus clause. Ceteris paribus. Old Latin students will recognize that as an ablative absolute construction, cateris paribus, meaning other things being the same, other things being equal. So the ceteris paribus clause doesn't affirmatively state anything, but it says there's nothing else in the act. And then they have what I call instrumental auxiliaries. They are theories about some measuring instrument, about some controlling or measuring instrument. An instrument of control, meaning it's something that does something to variables or holds them constant or eliminates them, like a white noise generator to mask small sounds, and an observational instrument, well, that's obvious. It's substitution for your eyes and ears. And the way you distinguish the instrumental auxiliaries from the theoretical auxiliaries is what science they're in. That's all. Now, that's rough, but it's good enough for our purposes. If I raise doubts about, in the old days, in the early days of the Skinner box, for example, what the lever actuated when the rat pressed it was a mercury switch, and they would sometimes get to chattering, and you'd get a cumulative record that wasn't quite right. Or if I'm studying emotional response of psychopaths, as in Dave Licken's PhD thesis, which became a classic of sorts, I have to worry about the electrodes. And some of Licken's early work dealt with the engineering aspects of that, which psychologists had tended to take for granted and be sort of careless about. Does it matter whether I use silver or copper or what kind of electrodes? How often do I have to clean them? Should I shave the subject's hand and braid the skin a little bit? And what happens if I don't? And there were things that psychologists were taking for granted, but Licken, having started out in the Institute of Technology, was more of an engineer, and his old man was an engineer, and so he focused on that, and it turned out that there were some failures to replicate that dealt with those questions. Well, how an electrode works in relation to the sweat glands is not part of psychological theory, is it? It's physiology, biochemistry, and electricity. I'm counting, therefore, as AT an auxiliary theory that belongs to the same science, so that I am not counting the multiphasic instrument as AI. If you're a psychologist studying schizophrenia and you're using the multiphasic, you are having a psychometric auxiliary. That multiphasic scale 8 is valid for schizotypy, or that Rorschach F minus is valid for brain damage or whatever. So this always means some other science than the one you're in. Now, of course, to the physicist and sometimes to the chemist and astronomer, that distinction is very hard to make, right? I mean, nuclear physics uses as its instruments elementary particles wonking around in there and colliding with one another, so that for the physicist, distinction would get a little messy. But for us, it's tolerably easy to make. If I'm relying on a theory of how a sweat works, or a theory about how galvanometers work, or a theory about photons when I'm doing something with a tachistoscope, all of that stuff is reliance upon AI, instrumental auxiliaries. And then CN, for conditions. Conditions means that the experimenter described to you what he did or what kind of subjects he collected. And obviously, I have to rely on his report that he did that right. My example last time of how you carry a white rat and whether you move too fast is an example of CN. CN is often incompletely described in psych journals. Or if I'm studying a certain theory of the genetics of schizophrenia, and I'm using a psychometric instrument to study to measure the schizoid tendencies of the first degree relatives of schizophrenes, and to compare them with MZ twins of schizophrenes, that all falls in here. But obviously, if I'm making any kind of point predictions from a genetic standpoint, say I have a dominant gene theory of schizophrenia or schizotypy, so I'm relying on getting the right value, not just a significant difference or something, but I want to get the right value. I need to get 50% for the first degree relatives. I need to get 100% for the MZ twins. That prediction of that percentage from behavior genetics is not going to be a fair test of the theory unless all of the probands were really schizophrenes. And it wouldn't take a very bad diagnostician, if he were relying on the ordinary mental status, or even worse, looking at a chart rather than on SADS, let us say, or a combination of SADS and the MULT. Ordinary diagnostic procedures may have reliabilities quite a bit too low, certainly enough to screw up an estimate that would be given by a particular genetic model. So that in behavior genetics, one of the first things you have to know is what's the reliability of the diagnoses of the probands. Well, what the logical structure of this setup is, that the conjunction, this dot is conjunction. I'm old-fashioned, I was raised on it. If you took logic recently, they probably gave you this as T conjoined with A conjoined with CP, like that. That conjunction of the substantive theory and the auxiliaries and nothing else systematically screwing things up, the ceteris paribus clause, and the measuring and controlling instruments being okay, and that I actually did what I said I did, that's how I chose my rats, or that how I injected my patients, or what, that mess on the left then deductively entails. Now, some of you may have been told in logic that this is always meta language and you shouldn't put it in the middle that way. Well, the logicians vary in that respect. The old notation there was the Lewis Langford hook. Whichever. I'm going to use this, instead of putting it in the front the way they did in Principia, I'm going to put it in here and make it object linguistic. It doesn't matter. You can say, well, this is meta language. I'm saying that what's over here follows deductively from what's over here. It doesn't matter. Observation one, horseshoe. Observation two. That's a schematic way of referring to two observations or 50 observations, and that would include, for example, a pair of observations that whose relationship is expressed by a correlation coefficient. I want to just do that schematically to cover all that stuff. So if I said, for example, all of the first-degree relatives of my schizophrenic probands who had the P50 anomaly and evoked auditory potential have SC scores above 60 on the MMPI, or that kind of remark. That's the diagram. This is the hook or the turnstile of strict implication or deducibility. It means that the machinery, the logical and mathematical machinery superimposed on this set of statements generates deductively what's on the right. We can't say that about the relationship of O1 and O2 because O1 doesn't entail O2, does it? So this is just a conditional. So what we say is, if the theory is true and the auxiliaries are true and the ceteris paribus clause is correct, nothing else is getting in the act, getting in the way to screw things up, and the instruments are okay, and you did what you said you did, then it follows, deduction, that if you observe O1, you will observe O2. On this side, we have a material conditional, simply the if O1, then O2, and that if-then relationship is a consequence of the stuff that's on the left. That's the basic model. Nope. If and only if can either be an entailment going in two directions or it can be this thing going in both directions. So strict entailment just means that it's deducible, formally deducible, as contrasted with the horseshoe in which there is no deducibility between the two sentences, but you're just claiming it is not true that this is T and this is F. That's material implication. It's the one of... It's, if Nixon is honest, I'll eat my hat. Whereas here, there's a, so to speak, internal relationship among the sentences that such that the logic machine will grind this out, like in a mathematical proof. Well, you can't go backwards. No, it's not if and only if. It's if, but it's a strong if of deducibility. Well, that's the general model of testing a scientific theory, and that is, so far as I know, not in controversy. That is, you do not have to be a disciple of Imre Lakatos or Karl Popper or Wesley Salmon to put that down, although I busted it up a little finer than they usually do. Since this is one-way derivability, since you can't deduce this conjunction from these facts, you never can deduce a scientific theory from the facts. Remember, that's the Morris Raphael Cohen joke. You never can deduce a theory from the facts. What you deduce is the facts from the theory. And because of the fact that this thing is in the invalid figure of the syllogism, formally invalid, we add... And on the background knowledge, as it's called, BK, loose, absent the theory, the probability of O2 conditional on O1 is small. You have to add that to keep this from being a vulgar blooper. If you intend to conclude for the theory and not commit a Bobby Soxer error in logic, you have to say, well, this conjunction entails this conditional of the facts. Now I got the facts, sure enough, I got O2 and I looked and it was O1. Or I got O1, I looked and I got O2. And so I have, quote, corroborated the theory, and you have only corroborated the theory to any significant extent if the probability of O2 on O1 absent the theory would be small. We don't know how to say how small. If you're hooked on significance testing, you would want to say, well, it's like alpha. It's O5 or O1. Well, it may be that small, but it's not identifiable with alpha because we are not talking at this point about significance testing. I haven't said a word about significance testing yet. I'll beat up on that in a moment. What we say is, Neil's theory of the weather says that it should rain on the 5 days next April and how many millimeters each day? It does. And we say, well, we're going to infer that with some confidence that Neil is right in his theory of the weather. What prevents that from being the fallacy of affirming the consequent, which it is formally? Because absent the theory, we wouldn't know how to say that, how many millimeters on those specific days. Now, you may say, well, I have a theory that'll do that too. The minute you come into the room with your theory, that will give you the same prediction about the 5 days, provided you didn't make it up after the fact, provided you didn't cut the cloth to fit the suit, or how's it go, the suit to fit the cloth, then we got two theories competing, and we have to think up some further tests. On this particular test, they're now very much in competition. They're running neck and neck. They both said something that is, absent the theory, hard to expect. Now, when that is very small, you meet Salmon's condition, the damn strange coincidence rule. And to read his exposition of that, the book that's on your suggested readings called, or maybe I put that up on the board, The Causal Scientific Explanation and the Causal Structure of the World. And look up Avogadro in the index, and there are about 10 pages devoted to the damn strange coincidence argument. Now, tell me, have I talked about Avogadro's number in any detail? I haven't talked about Perrin. Okay, well, we have to do that before we continue with Lakatos. Nobel laureate in physics. Forget his first name. Frenchman. At the turn of the century, there were chemists and physicists who firmly believed in the existence of atoms and molecules. You all take them for granted, of course. There were some very distinguished physicists and chemists who did not. Very top, not cranks, first-class physicists like Ernst Mach, Wilhelm Ostwald, the French physicist Pierre Duhem, chemist Le Chatelier, whose principle we all learned in chemistry, Poincaré. These are no pikers, right? And they all said there aren't any molecules. It's just a way of speaking. It's a convenient fiction that makes you feel good to do it that way, and work makes the math easy, maybe, but there aren't really any such things. They're Fig Newton of the scientist's imagination. Well, Perrin was a believer that there really were molecules, and the question was, how do you convince these fellows? And what he did was to write a book, Atoms, published 1910 or so, 10, 11, Atoms. Uh, in which he presented at the end of the book, after describing a lot of different experiments, mainly emphasizing his experiments on the Brownian motion, a table at the end that tells you how to estimate the number of molecules in 1 gram molecular weight. And the table shows that there are 13 ways to do it by 1910, and they all gave about the same answer. Avogadro's number, the number you have, Avogadro's principle, you recall, equal volumes of all gases under the same conditions of temperature and pressure have the same number of molecules. And that explains, that enables you to tell what the molecules of a compound are, because you have to get the volumes to add up properly when you take hydrogen and chlorine or whatever it is and get them to combine. You can't make it work out if water is HO or H2O2. The molecule has to be H2O to get those combining volumes right. And Avogadro's number is 6.02 times, they're little fellows, you know, so there are a lot of them, 6.02 times 10 to the 23. Perrin's own estimate was based on Brownian movement. You have a very small particle in, say, some water, and you trace the zigzags that it makes as it's bouncing around in there. You know, Brownian movement represents a perpetual motion machine of type 1. Perpetuum mobile of the first kind, that is, it goes on forever and you don't have to add anything to it. You can't do any work with it, so it's not a perpetuum mobile of type 2. Well, Einstein in 1905 and an independent fellow named Smoluchowski had worked out the mathematics of that and had said, now this particle is not a molecule, although there are plenty of small particles. Perrin himself, you tiny little things made out of gamboge, which were a micron in diameter. And the idea is that this particle in the fluid is subjected to the constant bombardment of the water molecules coming from one side and another, and how big a push it gets depends on how many of them gang up by chance, all pushing on the same side. And if you work out the mathematics of that, as Einstein and Smoluchowski did, you can write expressions for the mean displacement and I think for the distribution of the displacements as a function of the temperature. So that's one way to estimate, and in that derivation, Avogadro's number occurs, or numbers occur which enable you to get Avogadro's number, that has enabled you to say how many molecules on the average have to be lined up to do this. It's a rather complicated derivation. I've never tried to fight my way through it. But the point is, to get it, you have to start saying water is a bunch of little particles bouncing around in a random manner, and they are hitting this Brownian particle, and that's what makes it do this irregular zigzag displacement. It was a terrific experiment, and he got the Nobel Prize for the experiment. Well, there are other ways to estimate Avogadro's number. For instance, you can estimate it roughly from the fact that the sky is blue. I love that one. I can't remember how Lord Rayleigh did that. I mean, why isn't the sky pink, you know, or something else? Well, from the fact that the sky is blue, you could estimate how many molecules there are in a millimeter of air. You can estimate it from electrochemical processes, although I don't think he had that in his list. Very precise estimate. I have a solution of silver chloride, so I got Ag plus and Cl minus ions floating around in there, and I got the anode and the cathode. And no, he couldn't have had it because Millikan hadn't done the electron yet. But about that time, Millikan, with the oil drop experiment, tells us what the charge on the electron is in coulombs. And an ampere is 1 coulomb flowing past a point per second. So if we stick a couple of wires from our DC battery in this solution of silver chloride and wait for 20 hours, and we snip off the cathode and weigh it, those silver ions, each ion deposited there, picking up an electron, represents 1 electron in Millikan's sense, and so we can figure out coulombs per second, amperes times hours, how many electrons have passed through, and that means we can estimate very accurately how many atoms of silver moved over there to the cathode, and we find out how much, how many atoms of silver it takes to weigh 1 milligram. So you're in. Okay? Beautiful. He didn't have the X-ray stuff either. That's a good one. People had studied diffraction of light by humans making scratches very close together. There was an American physicist whose chief claim to fame was how close he could make them. And somebody came along and said, oh, well, I take molecules seriously, and I think a crystal of salt or of quartz is atoms lined up in lattices. And they would constitute sort of the big committee's scratches. We have here a diffraction grating which is a good deal finer than humans are able to make. Now, if X-rays are very short light waves beyond the ultraviolet, then they ought to act with regard to these God-given gratings the way visible light reacts going through gratings that we carve on glass or whatever, and we ought to be able to make rough quantitative predictions about the distribution of the diffraction pattern as a function of how far apart the molecules are in these lattices and relationship to the wavelength of the X-ray. And when you do that, it comes out right, as you can predict this is a function of these two input things. That's a very important point for psychologists to remember. If somebody had asked in 1910, when von Laue and Bragg and those other guys were doing this, say, which is your theory and which is your auxiliary? Are we assuming that X-rays are short light waves so that we can test the theory that there are molecules in lined up in lattices? Or are we assuming the molecular theory and as applied to the formation of crystals to test the claim that X-rays are very short light waves? Some people didn't think that. They thought there was something else. Some people thought they were very fast-moving electrons, for example. Others thought they were of a new nature. The idea that they were just past ultraviolet was in controversy. So you could find physicists in 1905, 1910, who were quite convinced that X-rays were just light waves past ultraviolet, shorter than ultraviolet, higher energy, but who had grave doubts about the reality of molecules. And you could find other people who were convinced about the molecules, but who didn't accept the wave theory of X-rays as just being short light. So now you could say, well, which was the theoretical, which was the auxiliary, and which was the theory being tested? You have to tell me which. Well, in 1910, the answer clearly was both. Both. We can't say that we're, quote, assuming one to prove the other. The logical structure of the argument isn't like that. It's the conjunction of the two that entail certain observational relations. And when it pans out to that extent, if it's a damn strange coincidence, we have tended to support both. Got to get relaxed about that. That's not what they tell you in Psych 1-2, is it? They tell you, first we got to validate X, and then we got X as a criterion, then we can validate Y, and then we got Y as a criterion, and then we can use that to validate Z, and that's the way you talked about validity, but that's a mistake, except in industrial psychology, where you have a predictive criterion, which is the one you actually want. But in any interesting theoretical argument, it isn't that clean. Kronbach and I pointed this out in 1955, and from one group of people, we got flack, and the rest of them mostly ignored it. But I'm still of that opinion, and I'm in good company, because that's what the logicians say about empirical science. There are many cases in which I am both validating a theory and validating a test at one and the same time. That only works if the conjunction of the two leads to a damn strange coincidence. Otherwise, it gets pretty flabby. Well, we'll talk more about that later, about the fact that I can confirm two things at once when I can show that the conjunction of them entails a risky prediction which pans out in the lab. or in my statistics. So Perrin took Brownian movement and the blue of the sky and some laws about specific heat and various other things, and he ended up with 13 different ways of estimating the number of molecules in a mole, and they were all around 6 times 10 to the 23. I say around that because they weren't all 6.02. There were some like 5.97 and 6.31 and stuff like that, but the biggie here, of course, is the order of magnitude, the exponent on the 10. By the way, that's the precise way to use the phrase order of magnitude, not the way sociologists and psychologists use it to mean about the same. Order of magnitude in astronomy and physics means the exponent on the 10 when you write a number in whatever units you're using this way, with only one digit to the left of the decimal. That's the technical meaning of order of magnitude. So if the incidence of alcoholism among Irish is 20 times what it is among Jews, which is roughly the figure, I think it's 18 to 1, that's one order of magnitude higher. Actually, it's about 20 times higher, which is 2 times 10 to the 1th higher, okay? well, that's a damn strange coincidence, isn't it? The sky is blue. Here's how the atom, the Brownian particle, bounces around. Here's what we get when we have a certain phenomenon about heat. Now I can add more recently the X-ray business and the deposit of silver and so forth. So we could probably get up to 20, 25 ways of doing it today. Perrin had 13, but people looked at that table. Here's all this qualitatively, completely non-overlapping stuff, you see? It's like my centurion sees across the Rubicon and I got mounds of ink in the library. Non-overlapping data level led to by a complicated derivation chain. But in each case, the derivation chain commencing with, let us assume there are small particles called molecules which are engaging in random motion, blah, blah, blah. And 13 ways that all give you order of magnitude 23. And even better than that, they all have roughly 6 over here. But it will be a little less than 6 and a little bigger. That convinced most people in a hurry. The great arch-positivist Ostwald, within, I think, 6 months of the appearance of Perrin's, well, it wasn't his book. He wrote an article a year or two before that had 8 ways, I think, in it. Ostwald immediately recanted after years of saying they're simply a convenient fiction, that they don't have any objective reality. There isn't any such animal as a molecule. And he threw in the sponge, and he said it very succinctly. If 13 ways to count something give the same number, then there must be something being counted. Which is plausible, right? If 13 ways of counting something, somethings, give the same answer, then the somethings are there. So you have the damn strange coincidence support for the reality of molecules. And Avogadro's number is one of the best examples there is in the history of science. It turned practically everybody into a believer in a hurry. Ernst Mach did not. He remained a positivist to his death, but he died 1913, I think, so it was only a couple of... If he'd had 4 or 5 more years to reflect, maybe he'd come around. Okay. Now... don't know whether or why I want to talk at this point about how about 2 things you wouldn't have done. Yeah, we'll do it. We'll come back to it, but I'll do it right now. There are 2 things that you wouldn't have done, or if you'd been forced to, they wouldn't have carried conviction. What if instead of predicting Avogadro's number, inferring it, and getting these 13 different ways with the same value, you had what we often have in soft psychology, merely a directional prediction. Suppose all you'd been able to say is if the current flows longer, you'll get more silver. And suppose all you'd been able to say is that if you heat up the water in your plate, the Browning particle will suffer bigger displacements. It's a function, the average displacement or the square root of it is a function of the Kelvin temperature. You didn't write the function, you just said the more the better, or the hotter the faster. That would not have convinced guys like Ostwald, would it? Why not? Because they would say, well, it's not enough of a damn strange coincidence. I mean, I can think of all sorts of gunky theories which will say the more the better. That doesn't tell me. You haven't convinced me there are any little molecules banging around in there. Of course, if I let the current flow longer, I'll get more. Because if I didn't let it flow at all, I wouldn't get any. Right? It's rather unexciting. So that would not have carried conviction. A significance test, or even 13 of them, would not have convinced the skeptics. Because why? Because while it's in the right direction, it is not enough of a damn strange coincidence. Or, speaking Popperian, it is not a sufficiently risky test. Well, now let's turn it around and do a significance test in the strong way that Carl Pearson did it, which I advocate on occasion. That would have been bad, too. You did it the strong way, where you used the test to refute the theory. That's the way you use significance tests in genetics. That's the way Carl Pearson used chi-square originally. Suppose you, I call that the strong use rather than the flabby use. Suppose you'd done the strong one. Well, then you would have taken some estimate of the variance given by each of these methods and done an F-test. Nobody knew about F in those days, but suppose they had. Well, they knew about Lexis ratio is like F. They could have done the equivalent of an F-test. What would have happened then? Well, I haven't done the math, but when you look at the distribution here, it's pretty obvious, since the measures, each of them has a fairly small variance, that the residual would have been small enough that the F would have been very big. And so you would have said, well, the theory predicts a certain agreement of the 13 ways of estimating Avogadro's number, and they don't agree with each other. They differ significantly at the O1 level by Fisher's F. So the molecular theory is false. That would have been even worse. I mean, the flabby use would have been bad because it wouldn't convert anybody. But the strong use, an F-test, would be terrible because, if taken seriously, it would have led people to abandon the molecular theory. Well, we know why they wouldn't agree, over and above chance, of course. The reason is that there are a set of significant factors involved in the derivation chains that violate things like the ceteris paribus clause, and there are major problems about the instrumentation and so forth. Many approximations occur, reliance on Stokes' law, for these particles falling, and we know from Millikan that Stokes' law needs a correction that Perrin didn't know about, and so on and so on and so on. So the flabby use of significance tests, that the X's are bigger than the Y's, would not have been catastrophic, but would not have convinced anybody. The strong use of significance tests would have been a scientific catastrophe because it would have led them to drop the theory of molecules, which it happens to be true. Well, we'll say more about the weak and the strong use later. A lot more. All right. Now, suppose you have a theory that you believe in, that you think has high verisimilitude. And you do the experiment, and you make observation O1 and not O2. Therefore, in the fourth figure of the syllogism, you have falsified the conjunction on the left. And that's not a matter of philosophy of science again, that's logic. This entails the conditional, if O1, then O2, we observe O1 in the lab or in our statistics, and we observe not O2. And so this is false. That if-then relation is false. And so we have what's on the left entails what's on the right, the O's, and that's false. Fourth figure, therefore that's false. So the left side is false. Now, here's where it comes to criticism of Popper by Lakatos and other critics. Lakatos does the best job because he was a pupil of Popper's and still had a lot of loyalty to the basic idea. The criticism is that the modus tollens is nice and neat and clean because it's in a valid figure of the syllogism, and that's fine and good for Popper to emphasize that, falsifiability of scientific theories, how a scientific theory differs from Freud and Marx and astrology and so forth. That's fine. But what we have falsified, tells the logician tells us, is this mess. The whole mess on the left is what is now false. That's all you can do with the modus tollens, right? The left hand entails the right side. The right side is empirically falsified by our observations. Therefore what? Therefore the left side is empirically false. But beginning logic, one learned that to deny P times Q times R times S is equivalent to either P is false, or Q is false, or R is false, or S is false. And that's not philosophy of science. That's a truth of formal logic. The formal equivalent of tilde on top of a conjunction is disjunctions between statements from the left that have tildes in front of them. Or, putting it shortly, the denial of a conjunction is a disjunction of the denial of the conjuncts. Bobby Soxer logic again, not controversial. So when we falsify the right in the lab, we falsify the left. But the left is a conjunction, and falsifying the conjunction simply forces us to say that something on the left is false, which is not what we intended. What we had our eye on is to find out whether big T is false. And now we realize that all we showed is that the whole mess on the left is false, and we don't know that big T is the culprit. Now, if that seems kind of abstract, take a psychological example. I'm a personality theorist, and I'm investigating a theory like Stanley Schachter's affiliation thing about anxiety and affiliation. And I have souped up Schachter's theory. He was never much interested in typology, but I'm a clinician, and so he's a social psychologist, and so I've got a notion that how introverts and extroverts respond to anxiety will be different. So I have got a Mills amended Schachter theory, all right? And my theory, which is now big T, I'm not counting Schachter as an auxiliary or mine as an auxiliary bell. I got big T, which is a fusion of a certain theory of affiliation and relationship to anxiety and a certain theory about what social introversion is as a dispositional trait. You could reformulate that so the second one is an auxiliary. That's not going to change the logical structure. So I'm going to make some college students anxious. And I believe in the projective methods. I like the Ampeachy Keene, so I'm going to use a structured test to pick out the introverts and the extroverts. I'll use the multiphasic scale 0, SI. Now, I have some faith in that. Mind you now, that's not an instrumental auxiliary. That's a psychological auxiliary because it involves psychometrics, which has got its own theory. And so I'm going to use the MMPI to divide people into introverts and extroverts, but I'm going to use the thematic apperception test to measure the intensity of their need affiliation. Murray's NF. Well, that's not dumb. That's a sensible thing. So I'm going to make these students anxious and compare their affiliation on, say, the odd-numbered Murray cards given before with the even-numbered ones, and I'll counterbalance it and so forth, to see whether their affiliative need goes up after I've made them anxious. And then I'm going to do an interaction design, between being made anxious and whether you are an introvert or extrovert, whether you are above or below the mean on multiphasic scale zero. That means automatically that I am no longer doing a pure experiment because I've got my eye on the interaction effect, and social introversion is not a variable I manipulate, but it's something the subjects bring with them. And when I get to the crud factor, this will turn out to be absolutely crucial in the argument. So we're going to have our Fisherian design has one part, one major effect. One thing I'm manipulating is a manipulated thing, and the other thing I'm not really manipulating, but I'm parsing the people. I'm divvying up the people. And any time you have either a trait or demographic or status variable rather than something you experiment upon, so to speak, you get into the crud factor problem that we'll discuss at length. But the design is not goofy, is it? I'm going to do something to them, and I'm going to see whether something changes, and then I'm going to get the interaction effect between what I did and whether they're introverts or extroverts. How am I going to make them anxious? Well, we don't want to use some artificial thing, and maybe the subject's committee won't let us shock them. So we'll say, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. They're all going to get little notices in the box, in their box, and it tells them what they did on the mid-quarter, and I'm going to tell the one group, the experimentals, are going to be told that they flunked the mid-quarter. And we assume that anybody who's got enough NH to be in college at this level wants not to flunk things. And so that should make them anxious. And so then they'll be anxious, and that'll soup up their affiliation, but the introverts won't be souped up as much as the extroverts. And a TAT shift in need affiliation when I score the responses to the cards, and that'll be my test of the Schachter-Mehl theory. Well, now we look at that. Suppose it doesn't work, doesn't pan out. Maybe I get a main effect, maybe I don't. If I get a main effect, I don't get the interaction effect. Or maybe the interaction effect is significantly negative, so half of my theory panned out. Typical PhD dissertation I'm describing. And so what am I going to do? Well, it's not hard at all to think of things that could have gone haywire, is it? You don't have to be a theoretical genius of high creativity to think of various things that might have gone haywire. The obvious first one that you might challenge was, I don't think the multiphasic is all that good, and I know damn well the TAT isn't that good, so I don't trust these auxiliaries. Or now let's take the ceteris paribus clause. We have to assume that we succeeded in making them anxious. Maybe you don't want to put that in here, you put that in here. I don't care where you put it, but we do have to assume we made them anxious. Well, ceteris paribus clause means that there isn't any systematic effect working counter to what we intend. We never mean by ceteris paribus, certainly not in psychology, that there are no other variables operative, right? I mean, there are always individual differences variables operative. And we wouldn't do a significance test unless we had something to put downstairs. And so IDs is downstairs plus errors of measurement. So CP doesn't mean no unknown factors are operating. What it means is the unknown factors operating have to be assumed to have been randomized with respect to the things that we manipulated or controlled. That's what that means. CP means no systematic other factors, all right? It can't just mean no other factors. That's never true. Even the lady, Fisher's lady, tasting the tea and the milk in the design of experiments. He says, scientists sometimes tell us that everything else has to be held constant. Well, that's ridiculous. We never can manage that. It's a little strong. Sometimes you can almost do it. But not in agronomy, not in social science. And he says, no, let's suppose the lady can't tell whether the milk or the tea was put in first. That was her claim. And we're giving her this sequence of 8 cups, and we've randomly assigned which one had the milk first and which one had the tea first. And she says, milk first, slurp, slurp, tea first, tea first. And the question is, does she do better than chance? And we can attach a probability to that, and a precise probability. And now Fisher says, notice this common statement in the books that we hold everything else constant. We don't hold constant whether her taste buds are getting a little fatigued as the thing goes on. We don't hold quite constant whether the tea is getting a little cooler. We can't probably hold constant the roughness of the edges of the cup. And then he goes on to say, and if we could do all of that technologically, it would be a dumb experiment because then we wouldn't know how well we could generalize to situations where those things are allowed to vary. Very good, Professor Fisher. And so he says, well, since we can't hold all this other junk constant, how can we get an exact probability? There's the man's smarts at work. He says, because if we assume deterministically all these other factors are operating to completely determine that on the fourth cup she says milk first, even though she can't discriminate it, all those other factors, fatigue, boredom, smell receptors, fire engine going by outside, getting bored, all of that stuff, temperature, all that stuff jointly determines her choice, he says. Omniscient Jones would know exactly what she's going to say on each of the eight cups. And Fisher says the way we get the probability out of that is by imposing upon that causal structure a random set of operations. That's why randomness is crucial in playing Fisher's game. That's interesting because in the last book he wrote, For His Death, there's a passage in there in which he repeats, randomization as a physical procedure is imperative for the application of my statistical methods. And then I asked the class, I won't do it today, usually I ask the people in this class, how many of you are doing a dissertation in which you have a defined population of subjects from which you drew by a table of random numbers the ones that you would study? Well, let's see a show of hands. How many are doing it that way? Nobody ever is, see? Never. I never get any hands. I never get a single hand go up in class and I ask them that. As an experiment, of course, you can talk about the finite population of rats of the Wistar stock that are hanging around in your lab and you're imposing the randomization on that. Okay. In a correlational study of schizophrenia, we don't know how to specify that population. I mean, do you mean all the schizos in the state hospitals in Minnesota, all the schizos in the Western Hemisphere, including the undiagnosed ones, and so forth? So when the statistician gets to moaning and groaning about whether I have a maximum likelihood estimator or an unbiased estimator, it rarely turns me on because he's talking about a mathematical relationship to give an exact value for a hypothesis which itself is inexact and for which the population can almost never be specified. I'm not saying it's terrible for you to do the research that way. I'm just saying we live in a little bit in the fantasy world when we think those alphas mean what they're usually thought to. Well, so I'm making these people anxious, and then I get to worrying after the experiment doesn't come out right. Did I make them all anxious? What about the comfortable gentleman C student? He's case hardened to getting a D. He didn't, what the hell, as long as the old man lets him join Row Dammit Row fraternity, he doesn't care. And so we didn't make him anxious, did we? He doesn't care. He's used to getting a D. I got a D, big deal. What about an extrovert who, however, is a very self-doubting, maybe not in social context, but in intellectual context, and who takes this very seriously and gets made so anxious as to be constricted when she takes the TAT, meaning that she tells short stories. Now, when Murray first published the TAT manual, you had to make a linear correction for number of words, as you would have to in the Rorschach if you were really going to take seriously the P percents and all of that stuff. I used to give the TAT to Dr. Sheely's private patients to pick up a few bucks. He had a lot of capitalist patients, and I'd give him a TAT. And I quit scoring on the Murray needs because I didn't have faith that this was anywhere near linear, and he never proved that it was. So we got a little problem there about one of our other auxiliaries, that is the effect of being overly anxious on whether you tell long or short stories in the TAT, and that'll screw up your estimate of need affiliation because one gives points for how you identify with the figures and so on. Suppose we have an A student who's has high self-confidence and good ego strength. And the A student, whether introvert or extrovert, thinks, this goofy mid-quarter, if they gave me a D on this mid-quarter, that prof ought to be committed. I mean, that's since, I mean, or there's, it's obviously a clerical error, and I'll go and talk to the prof, and it'll be cleared up. Most of the people in this room probably would have that mental set. I did as a student. Somebody told me I got a C in the mid-quarter, I'd think, well, that's a clerical error. In some classes, I thought if I didn't get the top grade, it'd be a clerical error. So, and there are people like that in here. And so, but what if you think that it's not a clerical error, and you didn't much like Professor Glatz anyway, and you thought it was a stupid exam, and your reaction is not anxiety, but anger. And since you are angry, you're pretty grumpy when you're taking the TAT. And secondly, hostility leads you to be not inclined to identify with the humans in the TAT, and it cuts down your need affiliation score in the TAT because you're angry instead of anxious. Well, you might say, well, that might sort of cancel out. Yeah, how much? All of the effect? Part of the effect? Does anger have more of an effect to hold down need affiliation on the TAT than anxiety has to soup it up if Stanley Schachter is right? Who knows? And nobody knows anything about that, right? So CP is likely to be all wet in this experiment. I mean, we, after the fact, we begin to scrutinize it with care. But before the fact, we should have thought about it. We should have thought, now, wait a minute. Even if Schachter is right about this affiliation anxiety linkage and Meal is right about it being interacting with social introversion, when I contemplate the various ways that people could handle this alleged threat, you flunked the mid-quarter, depending on whether they're dominant or self-confident or whether they have high IQs, whether their previous history is of getting good grades, whether they're paranoid towards college professors or not, and so on and so on. If we spent an hour, we could cook up umpty-ump possible interfering factors, and none of them would have to be far-fetched, would they? None of them have to be far-fetched. They'd be very plausible. Well, the problem then that arises when we do a modus tollens falsification of a theory is that what we have actually falsified from the logician's standpoint is a conjunction of things, five things, which in the social sciences, all of which are, to some degree, problematic. And in soft psychology, I would say some of them are almost certainly false. The probability of the ceteris paribus clause being literally correct in a study we do in clinical psych or personality or social, of CP being literally true, that there are no factors that are causally operated, that are systematic correlates of the things that we're manipulating, is, I would say, very, very unlikely. It's not certainly false, but it's almost certainly false. You can afford to bet that CP is false. Now, that the logician here will rightly point out that while from the standpoint of this strict structure, that means we don't know what we falsified. Of course, if we start distributing our confidences over this, in some situations, we would have a thing analogous to what the statistician calls robustness. That is, we would think that CP is itty-bitty false, but not false enough to screw up the power of the theory. And that may or may not be. And in some cases, if that's true, what you would ideally like would be a separate test of each of the alternative ways that can occur to you that CP might be false. There's 20 years of research cut out for you right there. Have I talked about need defense object combinations? All right. I know why I'm getting mixed up, because I've been lecturing to Joe Ida's counselors about this stuff, and I don't know what I've told them when I told you. Suppose we have some experiment like, the pratfall experiment of Aronson, Willerman and company, where it was shown that if you have a prestige figure that you're, I think you're not seeing this person, you're listening to a recording, and this prestige figure pulls a bloop or spills boiling coffee on his lap or something, and it is shown that your positive feelings or your evaluation of that individual rise as a result of this, but they don't rise if it's not a prestigeful figure. Now, I'm not poking fun at the experiment. It's a clever experiment, and I like it better than the ones that most of the social psych people do, which are so trivial. This is an interesting experiment, and it says something that my grandmother didn't already know. It goes beyond Bubba psychology, and it's a cute experiment, and I like Aronson. He's a smart man. He used to be here. But it's not hard to think of a half a dozen explanations of that which are different from the one that he comes up with. I mean, for example, suppose we think Freudian instead of like a social psychologist, and we say, well, because this is a prestige figure, I unconsciously feel competitive to him. Translate, I'd like to kill him, and or at least pull him down a peg. And now he kills himself by pouring boiling coffee on himself, and as a result I have guilt feelings because I wanted to kill him, and like the little kid who has a neurosis because he wants his little sister to die, and she does die, and they see a child analyst. And so I have to do undoing. And how do you undo negative attitudes to a person? You do something positive. So I rate him as a good fella. See? That's not hard. I figured out six different explanations other than Aronson's in about 5 minutes one day. And that's not doesn't mean that I'm disputing Aronson's is correct. It's just that you can't tell from that experiment which of these half dozen ones are correct. What that should normally mean is that in experiments of this sort, we ought to, before we think we've proved much of anything, theoretically we ought to consider the various combinations of drives and reactions and so forth that would be equally capable of doing this, and get out from the invalid figure of the syllogism by going through all of them. That means every one of these experiments should include an experiment to test the leading plausible competitors. Otherwise, you have given weak support. Suppose we take it Bayesian. Suppose there are six plausible ones and they're equally plausible. Well, then, plug it into Bayes' theorem, and what's the probability that I'm right in picking this particular one? It's 1 in 6. The odds are 5 to 1 against. If you think Bayesian.
Isn't it true that you might have different, your experimental manipulations for all these different testing will probably be different, and so you'll have different CPs with them, and it'll sort of just branch out.
That makes it still worse, doesn't it? Yeah. It metastasizes like a cancer through the nomological net. That's right. It's a terrible mess. It's a terrible mess. I don't think most people in soft psychology have reflected on how terrible a mess it is. And that's one of the reasons that soft psychology doesn't advance very far. Theories have this short half-life of 10 years, and then you talk about something else. It's very different from genetics or chemistry. Boy. In general, if you think about alternative interpretations, alternative to big T, there are a heck of a lot of them. You can figure out roughly what the magnitude of that is from the armchair. Suppose we say that we got 20 Murray needs. In our old Ford project, we used, I think it was 20. So we got need dominance, need affiliation, need aggression, need play, need nurturance, need succorance, need order. Those are the Murray needs. And easily, 20 mechanisms of defense, even without considering the very latest productions of the neo-Freudians, very easy to get 20 mechanisms of defense. We had 20 in our project. You got reaction formation, displacement, projection, fantasy, undoing, denial, repression, suppression, so forth, compensation, defenses. And then, of course, needs in psychodynamics, or in common discourse as well, have objects. We got, I think, 30 objects in our list. So you have need, defense, object combinations. Say the need is aggression, the object is Papa, and the defense is reaction formation. So I worry about my father's health, we'll say. Okay? Well, 20 times 20 gives you 400 configurations. Now, they're not all available for a particular experiment, but it's not hard, I find, to think up two or three that are available. Suppose there are only three that make sense in this particular experiment, and three defenses, and three objects. We got 27 need, defense, object configurations that are in the running somewhere. And to design experimental tests to exclude the competing 26, the ones that compete with the one that I have my eye on, is going to get us into his problem of different CPs and different auxiliaries will be involved in those. Well, Lakatosian defense, let us presuppose that a theory has enough going for us that it's rational to engage in a Lakatosian defense, rather than to say with Popper, oop, modus tollens, theory dead, go back to the drawing board. We're going to amend it. We're going to fool around with it. We're going to try to fix it. Now, that's not rational if I'm starting from ground zero. But let's say I have money in the bank. The theory has money in the bank. It has done well in the past. It has made some damn strange coincidence predictions that have panned out. That doesn't mean it's passed every test. Lakatos and Feyerabend give lots of examples of theories that flunked certain tests. But they passed others, and if the tests they passed were risky ones, and qualitatively diverse, then it's rational to stick to the theory. Does that mean you're denying it's falsified? No, it means you're saying even if it's falsified, I think it must have some verisimilitude or it wouldn't have done as well as it has done, even though it's false taken literally. That's one reason why we need the verisimilitude concept. We want to say the theory is false, but falsification, a la Popper, modus tollens, does not mean abandonment. We will stick to it, despite the fact that it's taken literally, it seems to be false. We will stick to it and see if we can fix it up. In other cases, we might cling to its literal truth and criticize one of these things which are available. But the point is, we want to start with a theory that has enough in the bank so that it's sensible to defend it. That's not what happens in most of soft psychology. Most theories in soft psychology do not have a highly impressive track record after the first 20 studies. They have a batting average of maybe 3 out of 4 if you're lucky. That is not a good batting average from the philosophy of science standpoint. That's a poor batting average because the 4 falsifiers are killers and the 3 confirmers are only weak because of the flabbiness of significance testing. I'm going to assume we have a theory which has money in the bank. It hasn't just said the boys are going to be taller than the girls or something like that, and we were right 7 times in 10. Look that up in the binomial numbers, and you'll see that's not very impressive at all. But it's made point predictions, or it's predicted the shape of mathematical functions, or it's predicted, let's say, the order of the size or rank order of several interaction effects, stuff like that, that constitutes a damn strange coincidence. So we're not using the significance test in its weak form. If we're using significance tests at all, we're using them in a strong form. We're testing a point value or a narrow interval value, which is a small region of the a priori possibilities or Spielraum, and it has done well. It hasn't passed every test. It's passed a number of stiff tests, and it's come close on some others. Coming close is just as important as being on the dime, as many people have pointed out in criticism of Popper. You don't say close but no cigar, or a miss is as good as a mile. If a theory is real close, you think it's got a lot going for it. If I predict 117 IQ and we miss by 2 points, and the Spielraum goes from 50 to 150, you'll be impressed properly. So the theory has money in the bank. Well, then what do we do? And Lakatos starts out by considering the various things that you could challenge. And he imagines you to be fending off the enemy falsifying your theory. You're fending off the falsifier by one rampart or bulwark or counterattack after another being pushed back towards the theory, and then even within the theory pushed back to what he calls the hard core. So that while you are sticking to the theory in the sense of saying, I don't know if it's literally true as it stands. My derivations involve that, but that's an idealization. And so I just figure it's got a high verisimilitude, and I'm going to stick to it. I'm going to try to repair it. And we have a certain amount of choice here, of course, because from the logician's standpoint, all he told us is tilde on the conjunction. So I could correct this or this or this or this, and I can do a lot of stuff challenging these before you force me to challenge T, if I'm stuck on T. I like T. It's been doing pretty well. Feyerabend, incidentally, has made a federal case of the point, but other people, not just him, that practically every big impressive theory in the history of science had falsifiers right from the start. Right from the start, including Newton, the paradigm case, the big theory. Right from the start, there were data that didn't fit Newton's theory. And he got mad at Flamsteed, the royal astronomer, and told Flamsteed he should be more careful and get his observations right, meaning so they'd agree with Newton's theory. He also accused Flamsteed of secreting females under Newton's bed for illicit purposes. Newton was, in my opinion, a schizophrene who was compensated much of the time, but at times was diagnosably psychotic. Well, where do you start? Well, one of the places we often start is with CN, or a combination of CN with this. That's what we do when we say, I'm going to wait to see if that replicates. The point about replication is that because of doubts about CN, we don't know whether this is a genuine effect, and so we wait for somebody other than Smith's lab to report it. That's probably the first line of defense in most sciences, and it's, I think, quite clearly ours. You can get accused of not being an empiricist if you say that, because it sounds like you're denying the facts, but that's not true, is it? It's not that you're denying the facts, you're denying that something is a fact. That's what you're saying. You're saying, I don't believe that given these conditions that O1 happened and O2 didn't happen. So that's a good place to look, very good place to start with your Lakatosian defense. This one's not too good for psychologists. Maybe it is for people in other fields, because most of the time the instruments that we use are, the physical instruments, I mean, are relatively trustworthy. As Fred Skinner says in page one of the great book, behavior tends to be macroscopic and slow. And having that property, we don't usually have to fret about that to the extent we do if we're talking about things that are very tiny or that happen very fast or that have very small amounts of energy and things like that. Sometimes, as in the Licken example in the GSR, you do have to worry about instrumental auxiliaries. This one is a biggie, because there you can almost assume, as I said, that it doesn't quite apply. Another reason why CP is a good one is that when we have different types of experiments over different qualitative domains of data, say rat learning, chimpanzee learning, human child learning speech, adult learning Morse code, so that qualitatively our database is diverse over our fact domains. By challenging CP in the particular experiment that didn't pan out, or in several experiments that didn't pan out that belong to the same domain, we are not in danger of screwing up the theory's success in the other domains. You see what happens to you if you challenge an auxiliary. If that auxiliary plays a role in the derivation chain to experiments in different domains, if it's close to the hard core, and you try to patch up this, you try to fix up this negative experiment by challenging the theoretical auxiliary, then all of the derivation chains that worked in the past that gave the theory its money in the bank that involved AT will now be screwed up. Whereas CP is likely to be more domain specific. That's just the way the mind is, or society is. It's just ceteris paribus clauses are likely to be, as his remark indicated, likely to be violated in different ways in different fact domains. Whereas there are many auxiliaries that are used over and over and over again with different organisms, different drives, different schedules, and so forth. So that's a better candidate, at least for psychologists. It probably wouldn't be a good candidate for physicists, chemists, and astronomers. For us, it's a very good candidate. What else might be doing this that got in the way? And if, for example, I challenge the ceteris paribus clause by adding an additional theoretical postulate that applies to the subdomain in which I began to fail, after my theory had accumulated money in the bank, and then I make the mistake of moving from rats to chimps, and everything goes to hell in a handbasket, and I think, well, there's some additional auxiliary I have to use to fix it up with chimps, and I don't want to screw up the good results I have with rats, so I modify CP. Now, CP is negative, so the way you modify CP is to add a postulate, right? You modify the ceteris paribus clause by adding a postulate. And suppose I add a postulate to take care of a couple of bad experiments with using chimps and tokens. And my theoretical auxiliary postulates a certain kind of process that I think chimps, being primates, are capable of in the way that the white rat is not. McCorkadale, who is a good Skinnerian, sarcastically said, "I think Fred moved from rats to pigeons because they're even stupider." So I've got this special auxiliary I need for the chimps or rhesus monkeys, and when I'm monkeying with tokens, and sure enough, that enables me to predict three or four different experiments that I hadn't thought of, which are suggested. That means, if you make it tight logically, that they are actually their consequences again of T together with these, together with this new one that's added, but is added for the monkey domains, the monkeys dealing with tokens. And I predict three new experiments, and they pan out. They pan out. What have I done? I have changed an apparent falsifier of T into a corroborator. I've changed the falsifier into a corroborator. It's like Lakatos' example of finding Neptune. Although in Lakatos' case, as I say, it postulated a new particular, a planet. Now we're postulating a new component of the theory, so it's a statement of general form. But I predict three new things. Now that's the kind of thing that Lakatos calls a progressive movement. When I ad hoc an apparent falsification by adding something that generates new predictions, it doesn't just explain away the falsifier. That's sinful. That's ad hoc one. He loves footnotes, subscripts, I mean. But that's ad hoc one. If it has additional content, as they say in the jargon, it adds content, it makes new predictions that we couldn't have ground out from the old postulate set without adding AT. And when we go in the lab, it works. That means it's not ad hoc two. Ad hoc one is terribly sinful. All it does is explain away a painful fact that doesn't predict anything else. That's a real bad sin. This is not a sin, it's just bad luck. It turns out that the new auxiliary wasn't correct, apparently. But if when I ad hoc the failure with the chimps and this particular context, and I drive some new predictions from that, and if they are risky enough, not trivial, not Bubba psychology for chimps, but risky, and they pan out, then I have not ad hoc two either. So now I have a program which is not degenerating, but is progressive. Ad hoc three, for completeness, he never explained. He says he got it talking with Licken and Meehl in Minneapolis. And essentially, ad hoc three means that even though it has consequences and even though they have a tendency to pan out, they are in some sense clearly scissors and paste tacked onto the theory, not springing from its leading core ideas or whatever. That's not a nonsensical remark, but he never got to spell it out in detail. There is something like tacking something onto the theory, and you say, this is so different from all the rest of the way this guy thinks that, I mean, what would you think if Skinner got an anomaly in the Skinner box and he said it's due to spillage of libido? Well, you would think, what? That's, Fred, that's not the way you do things, see? That's what he means by ad hoc three. I take care of this falsifier by talking about something that's totally unlike all the other core concepts of the theory, and the one thinks this is a scissors and this is a cosmetic job. Not everybody agrees with him about that because they say, look, if it's a cosmetic job that generates new predictions and hence is not ad hoc two, and if those predictions are sufficiently unlikely, it maybe means that Skinner should include libido into his system. So it's not exactly clear what you do with this one. I don't know how much I recognize that he's pointing to something there, as the example shows. But what that something is as regards theory appraisal, it's not easy to say. Well, so we can see why CP is a good place to look in conducting the Lakatosian defense. AT, we will do that with greater reluctance because of the fact that we will now have to ad hoc some things that before the theory was doing well with. But still, suppose that AT was being used only in a couple of the experiments that gave it money in the bank. They were impressive. And now I screw up in this experiment in this domain, and I see that I've got to change this one a little bit. And now I have a problem with a couple of those experiments. It's a little off for them, but suppose it's sufficiently strong as amended so that I can predict a half a dozen new ones. Well, then you'd begin to think that, I don't know exactly what you'd begin to think, but you'd begin to think that this was an amendment worth doing. The fact that the time sequence is regrettable is outbalanced intuitively by the number of successes. But the number of successes always have to take into account the unlikelihood factor. That is, you always have to ask Wesley Salmon's question, is this a damn strange coincidence? And if I made, say, a fairly weak prediction of only a couple of results, let's make it real weak. I merely said a significant difference would exist. That's real weak. And so that didn't help much to give the theory its money in the bank. It got its money in the bank from stronger predictions, from riskier ones. Now when I ad hoc it, I alter one of these, and I no longer am able to make this weak prediction of the A's are bigger than the B's, but I am able to make four very risky predictions, narrow range or point predictions or something like that, and say six of those pan out. I would probably settle for that as an improvement. I would say the theory, as it stands, is literally false. But we already knew that. We already knew that. All theories are lies. Some are black lies. Some are gray lies. This is a white lie. All theories are false. I have changed the postulate here, and it has screwed up something that gave it money in the bank, but it didn't give it much money. And now I've got six new predictions that are high risk. So I'll say the theory is in better shape than it was. But I did have to undo something in the previous track record. So what you're doing is fighting your way back to the hardcore, ad-hocking in the healthy sense. The quote there is Clark Gleamore, do not make a mockery of honest ad-hockery. And that's one to remember. One that gives you new predictions, and those predictions pan out, and they are sufficiently unlikely that they give you a damn strange coincidence. That's honest ad-hockery. Well, I'm pressed back to T, finally. I can't make it work. I have, what happens in a degenerating program is that you might get one or two successes. You fix up the bad experiment, then you maybe get a success or two, a weak one on a predicted one, and then you start falling into trouble with that one, and you have to ad hoc those. Each time you ad hoc some of those, you take some money out of the bank for the previous ad hoc step, right? So you have your theory, and you got some weak falsifications, as in soft psychology, because all you did is show the X's are bigger than the Y's. Then you run into some failures. Then you ad hoc. Now you have a new theory, T prime. You get a success or two. You've got to get at least one because you had that in mind when you ad hoc'd. You fixed it. Now you get two or three and then some bad ones, and you ad hoc that, and so it goes. And programs in soft psychology, like personality and clinical and social, you can read them, somebody's research career, and by Lakatos criteria, it's a degenerating program. But he gets famous as a psychologist. Because what? Because at each stage, the theory suggested some new experiments. Even though the actual track record is crappy. And the batting average at each stage is unimpressive for a Popperian, because a batting average of 4-1 or 3-2 is not impressive. Why not? Because of modus tollens. Two falsifiers is more potent than three corroborators. One falsifier is more potent than four corroborators, if you're willing to believe these other things, because it's in the fourth figure. A theory which fits nine facts and doesn't fit the tenth one, if you consider these, treat these as not problematic, that theory is swaying right there. So when a person reviews a theory in the psych bulletin and ends up with a nose count or a box score or batting average and says, well, of the experiments surveyed, it appears that a great majority have come out favorable or at least borderline, but there is a sizable minority that came out unfavorably, and therefore it appears that Fisbe's theory is in pretty good shape. Only a social scientist would say that. A logician would never say that. I mean, if you have a batting average of 7-3, you are not in good shape. You are not in good shape at all. Mm-hmm.
But if falsifier just tells you that you got a disjunction of the theoretical conjunction, may you not learn more from supporting the falsifier? You might need to learn from the theory.
Yes, that's why Lakatos says it's okay to carry out this kind of defensive strategy rather than throwing it into the ash can immediately. What I'm criticizing is a non-Popperian way of looking at it that's conventional in literature that really thinks that a box score of 7-3 is impressive when the 7 consists of the weak use of significance tests. And my contention is, and I know Lakatos agrees with me about this, Serlin and Lapsley say that Lakatos thinks things are a lot better shape than Meal does. That makes me laugh because Lakatos just spat on most soft psychology. He considered it a form of intellectual pollution, as he says. My contention is that while it is reasonable to persist in a Lakatosian defense, the assessment of whether it's reasonable to do that cannot reasonably be based on a box score of 7-3. When the 7 merely means we refuted H null. Now, if the 7 means that we made 7 risky predictions and 3 fell down, that's a different kettle of fish. That's where I side with Lakatos and Feyerabend against Popper. Well, I guess I'll have to wait till next time to talk about the hardcore. Yes, let's wait till next time for the hardcore. Good.